Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Maddock. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Maddock. In this episode of the show, we did a crossover with the Deep Dive podcast hosted by Whale Capper and Andy MSFW, Drew Dinsick, and Andy Molitor. So kind of did a half and half show. First half was me asking them questions, you know, really getting into their world. Then in the second half of the show, we transitioned, you know, talked a little bit more about DFS. But overall, just kind of a show about people who are in our world of speculating, of investing, you know, sports betting, DFS, stocks, crypto, you know, just kind of overall that whole world. So, and of course, some specific NFL futures takes as well, because that was kind of the whole idea behind the show. Please leave a rating and review on the show. That's the most helpful thing you could do right now. Yeah, just go to the iTunes, Google Play, wherever. Leave a rating and review. That will be very useful and very helpful. And you can also get bonus episodes of the show over on patreon.com/takecast. Now let's go ahead and get to the show. All right, guys, welcoming in Whale Capper, Drew Dinsick, and Andy Molitor at Andy MSFW. I think that's right off the top of my head. The boys from the Deep Dive podcast, a podcast I listen to every week. I assume a lot of the people who listen to the show also listen to these guys. And a couple weeks ago, I actually pre-COVID, we had plans to do a crossover podcast, yeah. Right? We were going to do it before March Madness, and kind of got shelved. So we've rallied the troops here to just discuss, you know, the world, like kind of the world that we all live in of speculating via fantasy, via gambling, via everything. So guys, thanks for doing this. Very, very excited to chat.
Dude, thanks for having us.
Yeah. I'd forgotten, like, you and I had a date. It was like a Monday morning. We were going to, I think it was the Monday after Selection Sunday. And I were going to talk college basketball, and I just DM'd you. I remember, like, it came up on my calendar. I'm like, hey, Davis, like, we're not doing that podcast.
Yeah,
right?
we don't have a show. there's no Selection Sunday to talk about, actually.
Yeah. More slap of reality as things got canceled.
So the main thing that I wanted to talk to you guys about was futures, and there are a couple reasons for this. First, everyone loves to bet futures, like literally like people who are not even savvy sports bettors, right? Like who doesn't love betting 20-1 and getting paid out in 6 months? And especially people are loving to bet futures right now because there's not that much for, you know, if you're not willing to bet on German soccer or Asian League of Legends, there's not that much to get down on for the North American sports bettor. So Drew, we'll start with you here. Just sort of generally speaking, how are you approaching wagering on futures versus wagering on immediately available games? Because I think the utility of the dollar is, like, I listen to a lot of sports betting podcasts, right? I've read a lot of books, and, you know, I have not heard, you know, the utility of the dollar over holding a ticket for 6 months versus wagering on something that's going to get settled within, let's say 72 hours or a week, whatever, if we're betting NFL games on Sunday night. How are you valuing that utility of the dollar?
That is it's an important question that I think every sports bettor needs to come up with a very specific strategy, because if you're just hitting the futures market willy-nilly as opposed to approaching it with kind of a systematic approach, I don't think you are going to find nearly the success, and it's going to be kind of a drain on your overall performance as a handicapper. And, you know, it can be detrimental in terms of, you know, how you think about your overall betting, especially come playoff time, if you don't have a very specific approach for NFL future betting. So I've kind of learned this the hard way through the years, and over the last three seasons I've kind of continually tried to upgrade and improve my overall process, and I have a couple of core tenets that I think are worth exploring. But you're right on your main point, which is that there's maybe no more fun bet to have in your pocket come Super Bowl Sunday than, hey, I bet this team when no one else believed in them. They're my team. Like, I made this right. I made this prediction. These guys were going to be here. They're going to win. I got them at 20-1. No one else saw this coming. These are my guys, right? Like, that is such a fun an incredibly powerful kind of experience. You know, it adds so much to the entertainment if you have that ticket relative, as opposed to just, hey, I'm coming into this game and I'm going to bet this team because I think the line's off by a point or whatever. So it's a very you know, it's a very cool part of sports betting overall. But again, you know, if you're just kind of throwing darts and you're just kind of picking a couple of teams at the beginning of the season and you don't really have an overall plan, the utility of the dollar thing matters a ton. Because number one, what do you do? Are you going to bet at like the same exact unit size that you would bet on a future, that you would bet on any, you know, you're going to bet on 9-10 games a week, right? Or are you going to specifically scale your bet in a way that you're putting away a little bit more bankroll? You're going to put a little more pressure on yourself if you're, you know, you're lightening your active account balance that you're going to wager on if you put away too much. And so I guess, you know, kind of from a philosophy standpoint, the lessons learned, which I think are worth kind of repeating for people who are either new to this or really haven't thought through, hey, I should have a plan or a process. You know, the market for futures in the NFL specifically is a dynamic marketplace. Every single week, the prices are going to change. We have prices now that are going to be pretty static, other than maybe major news like Andrew Luck retiring or something like that. Like, there's not going to be, I know that really that hit me in the nuts hard last year, but in general, there's not going to be a major reallocation of winning of probability between now and when the season starts, assuming we get a normal 16 game season and we already know who all of the schedules are going to be. Right. So there's not much is going to change between today and say September. Right. Numbers might get a little sharper. The mispriced, you know, outliers, especially at the high end, might change a little bit, but you're not going to have massive changes in the prices until we get to the games. And once the games start getting played, it is like a whole new board every week for the first 4 or 5 weeks of the season. Like every week you go and look and, you know, this team is 4-0. No one saw it coming. You know, Niners, great example last year. They got off to such a hot start. You know, 8-0 through, you know, 8 weeks or whatever it was. And it's like, you know, that was a team that was 20 or 30 to 1 to start the season. And that got bet down into the, you know, 5 to 1 range once it was obvious that that was a team that had a realistic possibility of getting the one seed and contending for a title. So, you know, these recognizing that the numbers are going to change over the course of the season is probably the most important aspect of all of this, because what that means is, you should approach this with the idea of, I'm going to build out a portfolio. I'm not just going to pick a couple horses that I think are going to win the race, right? I want to be able to time my market entry on all the teams that I think are realistic contenders, and I want to get the best price available on those teams over the course of the 6-month cycle, right? And that goes to say, you know, like in years past, after the Patriots start 1-3 through 4 weeks or whatever, and everybody's like, up, the end of the dynasty, you could have snapped up, you know, much more advantageous numbers on teams like that than you could have gotten before the season started. And so I think it's pretty important to kind of go into it with that mindset. And rather than just say, okay, well, these are teams, you know, from the outset, you probably are looking for specifically for teams that are just like ludicrously not well reflected by the market. You have to really look for true incorrect prices, and you should probably be coupling that with relatively soft first 4 weeks of the season, because you want to always be making a bet in the futures market that you think is going to accrue value over the life cycle of the market. Right? It should never just be, I like the Eagles this year, so I'm going to go bet the Eagles to win the Super Bowl. So I think kind of approaching it with that mindset first and foremost will help you improve your performance in the futures, you know, a long way. And, you know, you should not be thinking of it in terms of, well, I'm just going to make my bets now, lock up this bankroll for 6 months, and then, you know, we'll get it all resolved in February. You should be kind of thinking of it over, you know, how, you know, all of the rest of your betting you plan to undertake over the course of the season.
So I think another reason why people are so attracted to futures is it's much harder to calculate the hold just from eyeballing the lines, right? Like you're looking at all of them and you're like, oh, you know, that kind of adds up. Like, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, one team's plus 150, one team's plus 200, one team's plus 400. And then, you know, the worst team, you know, the Jaguars 18-1 or whatever. And you're like, oh yeah, you know, all of those lines, it probably adds up. It's probably fair. Whereas like, visually, you know, lines that are minus 140, minus 110. Like even, you know, my friends who've made like four bets in their lifetime look at that line and they're like, oh, actually, that doesn't make any sense. Why would I be betting on that when I can't even theoretically make money on either side over the long run? So, Andy, what is your philosophy in terms of betting into markets that have unfair holds? Like even if your numbers have the specific future number is good, we get into this a lot with golf betting, which I know that you've done some of in the past where like, you know, maybe your numbers have Hideki Matsuyama at 20-1 as like, that's still good value. But overall, the market is, you know, let's say there's like just some absurd hold, like 15, 18% hold or something absurd. You know, kind of how do you mentally calculate that stuff as far as it goes with EV and, you know, figuring out betting into markets with insane hold?
So it reminds me of something. I mean, Drew did it one day. We just started talking about it, and then naturally he finds a little time to run some numbers. And we were looking at the holds and, like, you know, the ones with the full complement of teams, like, to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was, like, 200% in some.
Yeah, just absurd.
Just wild holds. And at that point, you just got to deal with the fact that that's how it is. That's what you're betting into. You're still looking for value. And honestly, shopping around, you're going to, especially when you get into the smaller markets, let's say just to win a division where you're only dealing with four teams and they're not able to, you know, disguise such a high hold within a smaller amount of options in a bet like that, you can still find, I don't want to say like synthetic zero hold markets, but by shopping around, honestly, you can sometimes. I'll say you can. And
every once in a while, yeah.
Yeah, something to look for too is like, you know, just promo bets or things like that. Bet Online has that odds booster. I check that every day. I know I have people that post bets from there when they see value. It's just, you know, you can find some stupid numbers on some teams sometimes and just these promo bets. You maybe only get $100 on it, but at the same time, you can come back on another team later on and get some good value that way. But yeah, shopping around is definitely the case, especially with golf. I'm sure you've seen that with outrights. Like, that's the biggest pain in the butt for me with outright prices for golf is like opening up 10 windows. And after a certain point, it's just like, I bet DSI I'm closing. And this one I'm closing because it's been, you know, 15 weeks and I still haven't found them to be the best number for anything ever. So you get to know which books are best for which outright markets and start to gravitate that way. And, you know, like Bookmaker has some pretty good outright numbers on golf. But I mean, the holds are still going to be there. Just it's something you have to deal with. And if you don't think the number is good enough with that hold in that market, then, you know, maybe it's just a pass for you. It makes me think of tennis too. I used to do a tennis podcast, but tennis is completely dead except for some exhibition stuff. And my co-host, we were talking about the exact thing I started this little rant with, where Drew was figuring out the holds for the Super Bowl markets. And he started to do that with all the tennis tournaments we were betting on. And, you know, you have the majors, the slams, and then you have weeks where you have three of these 250s. And they're just these tiny little ones, sometimes in a city nobody wants to go to. You're taking a break after a bigger tournament. There's no big names there. It's a higher level of uncertainty at those tournaments because there's not like a clear winner, a clear one seed. Sometimes the number one seed isn't even like a top 25 player. He started to notice that. He just anecdotally, he thought the numbers kind of suck at these, and he went back because he has hard OCD about this. He went back and was figuring out the hold percentage at one specific book for every tennis tournament, and at those smaller tournaments it was much higher. Like, yeah, at the same book it was strategically placed higher. I mean, it's just
and the market is not as liquid, so they need to be making more money per bet on those for sure.
Yeah, so I think watch for that too. You know, if you are betting into smaller markets like that, you're going to end up paying a little more for stuff like that. And you better, I mean, your edge has to be bigger at that point, I guess, yeah, to make up for that. So
I think it's intuitive though, right? Like men's, like just sticking with the tennis example for a second, like if you had like the French Open, like guess what? The price on Nadal to win the French Open is going to be razor sharp. The price on Djokovic, the price on Federer, the price on Thiem, you know, the top of the market when you have known quantities like that, yeah, it's going to be really good, which I think goes to the point of like talking about hold and kind of conceptually thinking about this. This not all players have an equal percentage of the hold, right? Like some, like they build a futures market in some cases where they have true correct pricing at the top of the board, and they put most of the hold into the longer shots, recognizing that like somebody who's 100-1 on the board, you know, who's playing in his first ever French Open, like they're implying he has a 1% chance to win. Well, realistically, it's probably what, 0.0001, right? Like he ought to be 10,000,000-1 and he's 100-1, right? Like there is definitely an imbalance, especially proportionally, when it comes to hold and kind of the longer shots, I think. And I think, yeah, you know, it's a super successful strategy in horse racing for sure, not to try to just pick the winner, but to kind of throw out the ones that you think reasonably have 0% chance. And then whatever you're left with, maybe it's, you know, maybe you're putting, you know, maybe you're betting into, you know, 70%, 80% of the market, but you think you're capturing 100% of the win probability, right? Like that's a very specific philosophy that a lot of people who have succeeded in horse racing kind of take into any given race. If you can throw out the true 0%ers, which are swallowing up 1-5% of the hold, then you can start to rein that number in.
Yeah. So I think actually really related to the futures market is game of the year bets, right? So like, you know, we have week one lines. Actually, there are some offshore books that have literally like weeks 1-17 lines posted. I think my intuition would be that it is very much not worth it to get 2-3 points of closing line value. I mean, some of these games I'm sure will swing by a touchdown, right? And you'll be like, wow, look at all this value I locked in. But you know, obviously a lot of those line swings are going to be based on in-season injuries, right? Especially when we're talking about NFL games, like, you know, Dak Prescott gets hurt in week 7, and then, you know, all of the Cowboys lines week 8-17 are going to be, you know, really like they're going to be the exact opposite. So, Andy, in terms of like, you know, betting on NFL games like this far out where we're, you know, we're what, 5 months away from kickoff now, like, are you at all interested in wagering on specific games this far out?
We're not that far.
We had this conversation last summer. As we were first putting together, like, our – we don't per se have this, like, consensus power numbers, but when we start doing our previews, we start to see, like, hey, I agree that, you know, the market is probably overvaluing this team or undervaluing this team. And then we did that last year, and I don't even know if we did this on air, possibly part of it, but we started to go through – was it the Rams or the Falcons, Drew?
It was the Rams.
I believe it was the Rams. The Rams were rated – you know, as a team that had just been to the Super Bowl and was likely to win their division, and we were lower on them, and you started to go through those lines, and then it just snowballed, like, oh my God, should we bet against the Rams like 8 times this year before the games even start? And I mean, the answer was yes. Like, we screwed up by not doing that.
Right.
But at the same time, like, I think there's a delicate balance there of you really have to trust your numbers. You have to be right. And then again, like you said, you can't suffer, you know, injury variance if you really go all in on one team. I don't know if I'd recommend doing something like that, like betting if you really overvalue.
Yeah, betting against the Chiefs on like 12 lines or whatever.
Yeah, maybe don't put so many eggs in one basket like that. But definitely if you put your own numbers together and you strongly disagree with some of these games in the summer, if you trust your numbers and you've been right and you've been doing this for a while, I think I'm willing to put money and let it sit there for a few weeks or a few months to really crush some closing line value. What was the one you had? Lions pick 'em?
Yeah.
Or Arizona pick 'em? Whichever one where you got a push where everyone else lost when it tied.
Yeah.
You know, it would save you a couple of units if you get some of these down early. And I think we are going to look into doing this a little more because – definitely, like, we've hit on some of this stuff. We just haven't put our money behind it. And I think you just need to find, like, our maybe less than 10, I would say, like, the 10 strongest angles out of the 250-so-ever games and play around with it and see how they do this year.
I think, and I would piggyback on that and say, if you kind of look at a power rating that is implied by the overall numbers and just forget about everybody in the middle, right? That's, you know, they're probably going to end up in the middle, right? Maybe they're towards the bottom. Maybe they float to the, their opponent floats to the top, but that's going to be a hell of a lot harder to predict than just taking the top five and the bottom five, right? And looking, circling those matchups. Where do they occur on the calendar? Are they towards the end of the season? Like the Rams Cardinals was the best example of this of all time. Last year, the Cardinals, their power number implied like a minus six. The Rams power number implied like a plus six. So, you know, in LA late in the season, that was expected to be a 16-point game, right? And if you're like, okay, well, you know, there's a decent chance that maybe the Cardinals aren't the worst team in the NFL. There's a decent chance that the Rams aren't the best. There's a, that, that implies that, like, either only one of those two things has to be true for you to capture some big-time value when that game rolls around on the schedule. It just so happened that both of those things ended up being true, and I think the preseason line or whatever was minus 13 or something, you know, that game ended up going off minus three. So you had like a 10-point middle on that one, right? And so I think if you just kind of focus on the extremes and you look at where they fall in the calendar, you can probably do this blindly. And I think the other important thing to kind of zero in on here is you don't necessarily have to take the good – bet on the bad teams against the good teams. You can just say, okay, here are the bad teams, here's their schedule, and you can probably look for game of the year numbers that are on the right side of key numbers, right? Like if you have a team like the Bengals and they're expected to be bad as shit, but then you look at like week 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 from them, right? Maybe there's a game of the year there that you're going to get 3.5 against another bad team. Maybe there's a game of the year there where you're going to get, you know, the right side of 2.5 with a good team going up against another good team, right? Like the, you want those sort of, you know, those sort of key numbers in your pocket if you're going to go through this exercise for sure, because the whole idea really approaching the game of the year is when the game comes, you want to have, you know, massive line value on that ticket that's in your pocket.
So I think a question that a lot of people in our space have been thinking about with, you know, obviously, no games to bet on, right? I mean, I've bet on some League of Legends, and I like there's been DFS this whole time, so it's a little bit different. I think it's a little bit different for people who play like loads of DFS because they're just used to money come, money go. But I'm sort of wondering your guys' theory on like life role versus investment role, because really, you know, betting on sports, owning Bitcoin, altcoins, stocks, DFS, season-long leagues, like it's all the same idea of taking money you have and getting a greater return on that money, you know, finding the best ways to achieve ROI on that money. So I'm kind of just wondering, like, personally, do you guys have, is your sports betting role separate from investment role? And like, if you guys are playing daily fantasy, is that in the sports betting role, or is that its own separate thing? Like, do you have one investment role, and kind of what do you think is optimal with that?
Oh, man. Ooh, this is an interesting question.
I had to think about this one this afternoon.
Do you want to go first, Sandy?
Yeah, mine's kind of a mess, man. Like,
I mean, I think that answer question, is true for most people.
Yeah, the question kind of made me feel bad. Like when I went and looked at like how I manage things.
What am I doing?
it made me think of like, you know, part of the question of the first point you brought up about like futures and allocating bankroll. I think one of the main mistakes I made early on was like setting really hard guide. Like I tried to just be an authoritarian on myself with like bankroll management. Like this is how I'm going to do it. And it doesn't matter. Like I've really loosened that up as far as, hey, this is value. Like if I have 32 regular season win totals that I think are off, I'm going to bet all 32. And like, that's my bankroll. I try to make my bets a small enough part of my bankroll that I can make a massive amount of bets if I need to. Cause I had the same thing with college basketball. I'm like, man, am I betting too many games? It's like, no, just bet your edges, man. It let your bankroll be a big enough multiple of your bet size where it doesn't matter if you're putting, you know, 10, 15% of it into play, because you just still at the same time you have to play your edges. So I guess my crypto, I've told Drew this, and I think I talked to somebody else about this. When sports died, I took a lot of money out of my accounts, all of them. And that turned into more like, that just
more money.
I just turned into it like another crypto. Like, oh, this is my crypto now. So I bought a bunch of crypto at like whatever it was, 6,000. So that worked. Like, that was way better than betting this spring, I guess, because I'd have probably lost money on the NBA playoffs. So good job, Bitcoin, I guess. Like, my crypto role grew. But at the same time, you know, like, I think crypto DFS and betting are like one thing, and then investing, man, that seems like it's a whole nother thing for me. Like, I do keep that completely separate from this. The other ones kind of mix together a little. And I did play some UFC DFS the other day. I forgot how much I enjoy that, and then also how stupid tournaments are, because I got like all the fighters right. I just didn't put the right captain.
Yeah, and still didn't win. Tough scene. Yeah.
Stupid Andy doesn't know how to play the showdowns right.
You just need 50 lineups, right?
Two wasn't enough.
I guess I'll echo some of that sentiment. Like, as structured as my approach is to betting the futures market and establishing a portfolio, and as very sophisticated as that description might have sounded, like, I am way more haphazard and ought to have the same sort of philosophy and kind of thought process as it goes to bankroll. For sure, when I started doing this like 6-7 years ago, more seriously, my bankroll strategy was, I'm going to put $1,000 in this account before week one of the NFL season. I'm going to see how long this lasts. Right? Like, cross my fingers that I can play college basketball at this. Like, that was like my entire philosophy at that time. Right? And then as you got better at it, as I kind of realized, like, oh, wait, no, there is like an art to this that is much more than just using it for entertainment. I'm going to focus. I'm going to try to improve. I'm going to try to not have to, you know, continually redeposit to these accounts. Like, yeah, all of a sudden it was like, oh, okay, I haven't deposited in a year. Oh, this is wild. Like, yeah, okay. Like, now I'm thinking about, okay, how am I going to withdraw some money so I can pay for some extra Christmas presents or have a little bit more fun money, right? And at that point, it was like, yeah, buy a grill, exactly. And at that point was when Bitcoin really started to become a hell of a lot higher utility for this sort of thing. And so then it was like, oh, wait a second. Like, getting money on and off these offshore accounts is very, very straightforward if you're using Bitcoin. That is then, you know, lent itself to, like, you know, okay, well, all you have to do is by accident one day do a withdrawal from an account and then leave it, you know, you obviously the 30 minutes or an hour or whatever it takes to process you're sweating it out. Like, is it going to come through? Did I do it right? Like, is this all fine? And then once it gets in your account, like, okay, if you don't have like a, if you don't, you know, move it immediately and cash it out and sell it right away, like, you can blink and overnight, like, it can have grown, you know, a couple $100 or whatever. And you're like, whoa, what the hell? Like, and then you kind of realize that, like, the good, either the good way or the bad way, like, you can realize that, like, Bitcoin itself is, you know, is this commodity with a variable price that you have to kind of be cognizant of in conjunction with the utility of moving money on and off these books. And, you know, you realize, I realized the hard way one year, I was like, okay, after using Bitcoin a couple times, getting money on and off, I wasn't really, depositing and losing money sports betting anymore. And NFL season rolled around, and I was like, okay, I set a specific goal of how much I was going to put in. I bought enough Bitcoin to do it. I went and bet the entire NFL season, had like my best season to that point in my life, and it wasn't close. And then when I went to take Bitcoin out, this was before we did the podcast.
I was going to take credit.
I didn't even, I've improved even substantially from this point, but, you know, went go to take Bitcoin out at the end of the NFL season. And it had gone up so much in that time that I went in with 4 Bitcoin and I came out with 2, even though I had US dollar wise had done so well sports betting. So yeah, you know, you kind of, you go through this cycles and you're like, oh shit, like, okay, this is, there's a very specific, you know, there's a very, you know, speculative value in owning and holding some Bitcoin and keeping that as part of your overall kind of fun money, you know, the lottery ticket type of, you know, or not lottery ticket necessarily, but like, this is disposable income that I'm going to use to spend on vacations and presents and stuff like that. And that's kind of been most of my financial strategy and then investments and stuff for retirement, and, you know, like, actual kind of wealth building. I kind of stick to more traditional markets. And then, you know, this is just kind of on the side in case, you know, something happens to, you know, explode in the Bitcoin space. But
good point on why they, like, I think why the two have mixed and melded so much. just because we've used Bitcoin as such a utility to
trade. Yeah, you use Bitcoin just as an intermediary and not as much of like an actual investment. I have Bitcoin money that doesn't get touched. That like is not, it's not for sale. It's not for sports betting. Like when I need to make a transaction, I will buy some in US dollars, move it to my ledger, and then move it to wherever else. But the actual Bitcoin that I want to have for good is just it's on my ledger, and it's not going to go anywhere. Like that's a separate thing. And same for stocks. I think I guess the three of us are not in this category, but a lot of guys in our space are like traders, right? Or at least they are now. yeah. You see sports go away. Yeah. I mean, certainly this period of not having sports to watch every day has been the most invested I've ever been in the financial markets, because it's nice to have a sweat. And also everyone listening to this, and I assume you guys too, like just the fact that DraftKings stock was on sale for $17, $18, $19 that first day, and now it is. I mean, it is the most explosive stock on the market, really. It's, it just goes up 5% every day, it feels like. There are definitely a lot of guys in our space who feel that they have a really good handle on the financial markets, whether they do or not. And I don't include myself in that, in the sense that I think I have a good handle on it, but there are people who certainly would like feel more comfortable buying a stock on Monday, selling it on Friday than they would have 3 months ago. Like, so there are probably more people who are using some of their gambling money on Robinhood or Charles Schwab or whatever.
I know that happened. Sure, right. Like somebody paid me out on Cash App, and that has like a shitty trading app. And all of a sudden I was like, I was day trading. And then I realized I'm like, oh shit, I made a bunch of money on this again. Like I just hit a couple lucky ones, 'cause I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And I tried to sell a stock, and it's like, oh no, you can't do that. You've reached your limit on day trades, sir. We discourage day trading here, so you can sell this tomorrow morning. And like I wake up in the morning and check the pre-market numbers, and it dropped like a rock, and I ended up losing money. Like I need to get this into like an actual investment site, because that was a problem. Did you see Bitcoin? It's 10.3.
It's 10K. As we are speaking right now, you never know. You never know what's going to happen literally in the hours that follow when we are recording. But as of this literal moment that we are recording, we are trading at like about 10.1.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, but no, kind of in the same sort of sentiment that you had, Davis, when the speculative bubble went up in December 2017, like that was like so impossibly good that I had a decent amount at the time, and it, 10, you make an investment that 10x's, you're just like you can't make rational decisions anymore. And at that point I was like, okay, well I'm taking some profits here, and I'm buying I bought a Trezor, and I was like, the rest of this is going on this, and I'm putting it, somewhere safe, and whatever happens in 2020, 2022, we'll revisit this, like that was sort of my thinking at the time. And so I definitely kind of think of that in the same sort of like, hey, I'm holding onto this, rare piece of, memorabilia that, that may end up being, like the next, may end up being the next, absolutely impossibly good investment to have, but maybe not. So, but the utility part of it, and how you manage your bankroll, and what you're doing with that, like I kind of have the same sort of philosophy where it's like, once you have enough profit that you can take some and then not really hurt the initial egg that you started with, that's kind of my overall philosophy. And so sometimes that's tied into if I have a specific point of view on on a futures, or like a specific point of view on playing the NBA playoff, like series markets or something like that, like I'll get a little bit more, put more time into it from a handicapping perspective, put more money into it, and then take whatever the profits are out of that, and entirely independent of whatever the bankroll I started was.
I think that I need to make this clear, I've never taken any profits on Bitcoin, and I won't, I'm not doing it until 100K or whatever. Like, I just, I'm such a true believer that I just, like, what am I going to sell at 10K and make, you know, a little bit, like, it's not going to change my life until Bitcoin is like a life changing thing. You know,
what's your bull case? Like, what is the prime, what's the fundamental reason that you are bullish on it to that too?
The United States this year alone has printed $3 trillion. And there's about 10,000 Bitcoins mined a month. And that might be high, right? Because of the halving and because, you know, some miners are just, it's going to become too expensive. So, you know, over time, less and less actually, this is, I just read an article this morning, this crypto fund Grayscale, just this one crypto fund, it's confirmed that they have purchased more Bitcoins this month than have been mined. So like it's literally an asset that is hard to get and so many people want it. It is becoming like every day it's becoming harder and scarcer to buy Bitcoins.
But you think it's the IRS is basically coming out, you know, going after just who is buying and holding because they recognize it as a, you know, as people who are
right
accumulating wealth. But you think it's mostly that the retail investors and the demand from the retail investment side is going to drive the next bull run?
No, I think institutional investing, because we're finally seeing
investing.
It.
Okay.
So like, I think as far as retail investing, the most we were ever going to see was that November, December 2017 run, right? Like I don't know if, even if Bitcoin does become worth insane amounts of money, I don't know if we will ever see a retail run where like your uncle was asking you to set him up with a Coinbase account to buy $100 worth of Bitcoin. Like I don't know if we'll ever see that sort of mania again, but it's like, it's confirmed that some of these big, you know, very institutional investing firms are starting to expose their clients, you know, their very, very rich clients to Bitcoins and in ways that their clients don't understand a lot of the time. But like it's starting to happen.
Mm.
I saw that same article, Davis, and that did like exactly what you said. It made me feel like if big institutions are buying that amount of
that much,
and there are this many miners that are, you know, going offline because their electricity has become too expensive that they can't mine at a profit anymore. Like legitimately, we could create actual tangible on paper scarcity, which would be just great.
It's the same argument that has ever existed for gold, except like we actually know there's a legitimate finite amount. Like theoretically there's like more ways to get gold. Like there might be gold on other planets and stuff. Like really, like that's a thing that like could happen, and there's more gold to be found in the earth, and we don't know how much, but we know that it's there. No one knows the actual amount of gold that exists in the world, but like we know it's 21.85 million Bitcoins that will ever exist. Right. And there will never be any more than that, which is, that's my soapbox. Everyone on this podcast is always so sick of hearing me talk about it. But, that's my soapbox.
If you want to get delusionally optimistic, start thinking through what happens when there's like a liquidity shortage in foreign markets for paying debt, and you know how currencies and foreign market currencies start to lose value, and how the wealthy people in emerging markets will seek something that's more stable than their for home currency. Like I think the people who kind of poo-poo the bull case, which is that U.S. dollar printing will beget inflation, and this is an inflation, resistant, commodity. Like, I don't think that's as likely or as meaningful. I don't even think you need that. You just need one more Venezuela. You know, you just need one more or one or two more, emerging markets to completely lose control of their currency for whatever reason. And then those people seek Bitcoin as a store of, store of value.
And as more and more people become technically proficient, and people who are not technically proficient, either turn their money over to, their kids or their financial advisors. And there are more and more guys who are, our age, late 20s, early 30s, who are, in upper management positions at these hedge funds. And, in college, they probably bought Bitcoin or got, were exposed to Bitcoin, and they're like, oh, this isn't some crazy, you know, this isn't funny internet money. There's like real reasons to be invested in this. And those guys' voices are going to get like Jamie Dimon's going to stop talking. And, you know, these 32-year-old hotshot hedge fund managers are going to be like, yeah, let's buy $3 million worth of Bitcoin.
No, JP Morgan's already on board. Jamie Dimon's already turned his,
is that true? I can't even keep track of that anymore.
Anyway, I don't know if Jamie Dimon personally is, but whatever the case is, JP Morgan is a major player now. Anyway, the entire philosophy I went into last NFL season with was like, the halving is coming. I'm going to accumulate as much Bitcoin via sports betting as I possibly can this year. Like previous years, I was like, I have this trip in mind that I want to pay for with the sports, you know, with a run. But this last year, it's been almost entirely like, I want to accumulate. Well, now I can't go anywhere, so it's literally is
no vacations to plan for, just stack sats.
Yeah, right. Just exactly stack sats and retire early, ideally.
Yeah, we can talk Satoshis. Yeah, we can talk some NFL futures at the end of the show. We can go over now to some of the questions that you guys have for me now.
Okay, cool. Andy, why don't you go first?
Oh, you wrote all these questions, which God bless you. You had more time than me today, apparently, because I just could not find the time. But basically, you covered everything I was thinking about, because Davis is so much more fantasy and DFS fluent than us. Like, I mean, I kind of exposed how stupid I am with DFS. I played 2 entries in a tournament that takes 150 max entries, so... I mean, obviously, I'm not good at DFS.
Not great. There are contests that are good if you only want to do 2, but they don't have 50K to first. Yeah.
Yeah. No, like, essentially, I got 5th. And, you know, a $10 entry wins, like, $40.
Yeah.
Because you actually, you know, tied with, like, 500 because of all the chops. Yeah, a lot of chops. Like, nobody won the big prize. It was a big, big chop at the top. So, I guess DFS is... I'm dumb with that, but the second question here kind of made me think, like, what were the key points on your journey to becoming like an expert in this is DFS? Like, every time I think about DFS, I get a headache, because it just feels like you're approaching the market the same. You're approaching the exact same markets we're approaching, sports betting, but you got to come at it from such a different angle, because it's not just find the best price, bet it. You know, compare your numbers, find value. It almost sounds like I'm making sports betting sound easy compared to DFS. And I guess in my mind, it is, because I just am so unfamiliar with so much of the game theory that I do it mostly for fun. So, I mean, how did you get to this point?
Well, so DFS did not used to be hard. Like when playing in like 2013, 2014, DFS, like you could win if you just like all your guys were in the lineup and like not bad players, like NBA, like I built my role for like life in like NBA daily fantasy in like 2012, 2013, 2014, when, you know, no one really had projections. Even injury updates weren't like, you know, Fantasy Labs has their account that everyone follows that like the second an injury report gets updated, it goes out to everybody. But like, you used to have to like Twitter search for guys' names to like find out if guys were going to be playing or not. Like it doesn't make me special that I was a winner then. Basically, it just meant that I was like a college kid who had time and was like willing to grind a little bit, you know, more or less. And then there was I don't even know how much you guys know about like the ins and outs of DFS. Like, do you know about Ethan Gate? Do you know what that was?
No.
I'm gonna say
so no. Ethan Haskell was an employee of DraftKings.
Oh, I do know.
Okay. Yeah, yes, who won a tournament on FanDuel. And you know, it was basically intimated that he was using the ownership percentages that he knew on DraftKings, because he accidentally posted an article early that had ownership percentages in them from contests that had locked, but the players had not locked yet. So it was basically intimated that this guy was cheating. And this was after all those FanDuel and DraftKings commercials were on everyone's TV all the time. Yeah. Right. And there was all, and then basically that drove a lot of the good money out of the market, you know, kind of very similar to like how poker in the United States, you know, even if you were playing live games professionally before Black Friday, just no one plays cards anymore. Like, the only people that play poker from like 2010 to 2015 in the States were just like criminals or grinders. Like that was it. There were just no good games. And DFS kind of had that period. And now everyone has access to projections. Everyone has access to lineup optimizers. So creating winning lineups is just way, way more about game theory, right? Anticipating what your opponents are going to do and finding ways to exploit that strategy. You know, basically just finding those very small edges, or kind of what you guys or what Andy does for college basketball, and just playing really small contests for sports that people don't care about. Like I set my alarm clock for 6:30 this morning to set my lineups for Danish Super League soccer DFS on DraftKings, right? And like I'm getting like, you know, $350 of action in that slate, but it's all good action where like every game I get is going to be good basically. And that's like the other thing that people do. But people who are really profitable at it now are, they have a ton of money to put into it, and they are really good at game theory of just like, these players are not going to be owned at the level that they should be, and this group of players is going to be owned way more than they should be, and that's how I'm going to exploit it.
Mm. Well, love that. Okay. I had
a you always sort hear of people say like I'm fading this player, you know, and like I had to think about it. I asked one guy, I'm like, how the hell? He's like, oh, you just don't put him in lineups. I'm like, oh, I feel stupid asking now. Like, yeah, I get what you're saying. Like, you take a, you know, a player that's going to be popular and just don't put him in lineups. And if it doesn't work, I suppose it's freaking disastrous. But
it's also like accepting that, you know, in a lot of slates, you're not going to get money back, right? Like, let's say, you know, I play 150 lineups every night for a month in baseball. And realistically, what you're trying to do is win the big tournament that you were entering over that time frame once. You know, like if you win first place in the big contest that you were putting 150 lineups and you win that twice in one season, that makes your year. And if you just run bad and you get third instead of first twice, like that can mean you have like a negative ROI year. It is a real, real grinder's game if you are going to be max entering, right? And people like, yeah, it's like, you know, people just think it's easy, right? You enter 150 and you win. And I've done it. And like, so for baseball in like baseball last year, DraftKings actually has this great contest for people who want to enter 150 lineups, but aren't, you know, literally don't have literal millions of dollars. They have a $1. It's generally either $2,000 or $3,000 to first, and you can put in 150 teams. And I won that four times over the course of the year, but I think my ROI was like 10%, and that was with getting first what would be for sure above my expected value of those entries. So like it's not easy.
Mm, got it. That's interesting. So it's in a lot of similar way. In a lot of similar way, you know, to be successful long term is about understanding the market, understanding the players in the market,
and understanding your edge and exploiting your edge as much as possible. Instead of like if you don't have an edge, you're just, you know, putting bad money after bad, basically.
Yeah, plenty of that in sports.
I guess I did listen to some, I don't remember who it was, on a podcast who talked about his DFS, and he said, like, you know, all the 50-50s or double ups or whatever head-to-heads I'm playing, that's just so hopefully I break even every day that I don't win a giant tournament. He's like, hopefully I don't lose too much. He's like, it pays for your max entries on the one where,
right,
you just need that good lineup, you need a little bit of variance,
which is,
and you have so, a huge win.
Like that is what professionals were doing when the games were good, right? 2013, 2014, 2015, they were playing one team and they were entering that one team into every contest. Like they were going in the DraftKings lobby with one team and literally putting that contest in every game that they could get action on, you know, so like Empire Maker, Sahil Sood when he was around, like, and that just, I mean, some people still do it, and these are, you know, top 0.1% players who can do that, beat the rake, and you know, not get crushed. It's very hard at the highest stakes. You know, very similar to poker in the sense of like it's just the margins are super, super thin.
Wow. That's interesting.
Like those games are kind of dead now. Like like finding, like to be able to get like $20,000 in action on an NBA slate now, you'd either have to be playing people who are super good and you think you have like a margin thin edge on, so you got to play them 200 times in a year for that edge to be exploited, or you're just getting that money down in tournaments instead.
Wow. Man.
Yeah, and I'm done doing NASCAR ones. That can suck my butt. Like, I
yeah, NASCAR is super game theory heavy. Yeah.
I run bad in NASCAR. Like, I don't remember who it was that not this last race, but the race before, who basically just took like negative 19 positions because he just was going to start the race and then drive off and not race because of something. And it's like, oh, all your lineups are dead, basically, at that point. Like, cool, I won't even watch them.
Yeah.
Yep, just so MMA for me, just MMA savant.
So how many years have you been putting into creating content for DFS, out of curiosity?
I started my own website in late 2010. So it'll
late
be
– 2010.
It's been a decade. Sheesh.
Okay, so you basically have been around and participating in creating content through like the entire life cycle of the DFS content space, right? Like you saw that was 2010, I imagine. That was super early.
Yeah, like I played DFS on sites that like people who started playing 5 years ago have never heard of, like Daily Joust. I played on a site that used like defensive special teams in college football, which like you can imagine the scoring for that just gets, you know, absolutely absurd, right? So like,
yes,
I've definitely seen it all as it pertains to daily fantasy sports, that's for sure.
Okay, so
I played on an off-brand site once. Are there any of those left, or did they just all get bought?
There are a couple left. Like the last one that I had money on, let's even see if it still exists. Okay, let's take bets right now. Do we think I have any money left on fantasydraft.com? Do we think that when I log into my account, do we think I'm going to have any money left?
Yes. You always leave something there just in case you hear about a bad number.
Free daily fantasy, bud.
It was like you had to subscribe, right? You pay like $10 a month and then you could pay rake free.
When I'm done playing at a place, unless they've like shut me down specifically in terms of limits and action, you leave
15 bucks on?
Yeah, 50 bucks in there just in case you hear like, holy crap, they are way off market on blank, and just you go fire it away. You don't want to have to wait for the Bitcoin. Even when I drew down when sports stopped, I still left, you know, $500.
I have $5 left on fantasydraft.com.
$5.
Which is theoretically a daily fantasy site that still exists, though I can't imagine. They have very much going on. DK and FanDuel just got to have like a 99% market share at this point.
Jesus. Wow.
Yeah, I played on one. It started with an A, and I can't remember it. And I liked it. They had some fun, like, Survivor contests that rolled. Like, they started every week. And then I remember the next year, it was like, oh, this site got bought. It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, there were – my favorite ever site was Draft Street, which – is like a dinosaur. Like a dinosaur reference at this point. Like people listening to this are like, Draft Street? What are you talking about? Draft Street. That was actually a site where the pricing was so good and so dynamic for NBA that like people who were really, really good and really paying attention actually did have like a really big edge. Like if you were projecting the right minutes for Sacramento's third string point guard, you were getting an edge there.
That's awesome. That is awesome. I love stories that. That definitely
just makes my head spin thinking about modeling that hard at the player level for NBA.
Well, I have never built a model. I just have always had access to really, really good projections and have been diligent about making, you know, like manual adjustments and stuff. But like, sure. I don't have the modeling like skills or background at all.
Got it. What about so from the content side of things, you've seen kind of how the space has changed in 10 years and daily fantasy, you know,
so different.
What do you think about the way that sports betting content is evolving? What do you think the ceiling is? Do you think at some point we catch the same number of eyeballs, ear balls, as you know you typically have in a daily fantasy? Do you think that's coming fast?
I think it's already turning. I think people. So one, I mean, what you guys are saying is, I actually think beating the market long term in sports betting is way harder than beating the market in daily fantasy. Like I think you're so much more likely to be a winner. You know, if you're working hard, you're selecting the right contest, you are, you know, really diligent about who you, like I'm not good at entering 150 teams, so I'm gonna enter single entry contests for a higher dollar level, you know, like $100 single entry, $50 single entry. Like beating sports betting is a lot harder, but it's so much easier to just run hot on sports betting over like a short period and to convince yourself you're a winner. And it's like more fun too. It's less like, if you're not taking it super seriously, it's just way less work to bet $10 on a Broncos game or $20 on a Lakers game. Like it's like a little bit more fun. And there's still stuff that is exploitable for people who are not trying to get thousands of dollars down, like player props and stuff like that. Like everyone in daily fantasy is vying to get into that sports betting market as the tide turns. Like everyone knows, like that's where the money is, because so many more people are going to be interested in that, willing to spend money on it. Like it's not even close.
It was an interesting question though. Like I saw you pose that, and you know, you basically posed it as, when will sports betting content reach the level of DFS content? And I'm, you know, I just think about most of what podcast articles, that is a big part of it, but a lot of what I take in is just Twitter, and I'm just so able to curate my own Twitter. Yeah. I had to think, I'm like, is DFS way bigger than sports betting? Just because, you know, obviously I follow a few DFS people, but like, I'm sure there's people that are just hardcore to DFS, and all they do is follow DFS people, and like all their content is curated that way. And maybe they feel it's the other way, but you know, I don't see a ton of DFS content just because I don't choose to follow too many. You know, I follow like Davis and Jennings and a few other people, and that's about it for DFS. So I don't see.
But you even see people like me, like Jennings. Like I get way more interaction on like betting stuff now than I would, like, especially like when you lose a bet, right? People just love to be like, oh, you tweeted this bet and you lost, like you're such an idiot. Like people love idiot. Yeah, people love that
you
stuff
lose,
like,
bets?
That's, oh yeah,
mistake number one right there.
Yeah, big time. Like that. I like to post soccer bets, which I'm not good at, but I would never write an article about betting on soccer, because like that's not something I'm taking seriously at all. Like that's just fun for me, because I like to watch soccer, and like people just love to rail on those bets, like just because it's fun. It's fun to laugh at someone when they lose.
I guess think it's easier to follow along, because like if you say, hey, I'm betting on Brondby. Like, let's stick to the Danish Soccer League there or whatever. And I'm betting them minus one tomorrow. Like, somebody just go to their book and bet that, where it's like, hey, yeah, I'm
no thought required at all.
Yep, no right, thought, yeah. Where it's like, hey, I'm entering 150 lineups into it, and if you want, here's a spreadsheet, and you can look at them all and chop all these pots with me if you'd like. Like, nobody, I guess somebody might. You know,
oh no, there are still people there's still people who like sell lineups, which is like this whole scummy DFS thing. Like it does happen. Sure. It's against the terms of service on both DraftKings and FanDuel, but it does still sort of happen. But like, I actually, this is not a popular opinion at all. I really like to talk about DFS with people. I really like to like go on shows and be like, this is what I think about these plays. And as we were talking about the evolution of daily fantasy content, it used to be I would go on a show and I'd be like, these are the guys I want to play in cash games, right? Head-to-heads, double-ups, 50-50s. And now it's pretty much exclusively tournament strategy talk. So, like, I like this guy. I think he's going to score a lot of points, but he's going to be way over-owned relative to this guy who's priced right next to him, who has, like, a lower baseline but a similar ceiling. So it's, like, that evolution. I mean, I don't even know if people are even still, like, doing, like, cash game content, like picks content, like that stuff is not popular at all anymore.
Wow.
I get into some of that. I love listening to the game theory part of that. Like my guys that do some golf, Haven and JD, they don't do a ton of DFS, but like we find some pretty good edges on some daily golf stuff. I think that's why
golf DFS is amazing, by the way. I would say that is the most fun. Yeah.
Yeah, well, just sure. Like the showdowns, the daily showdown
showdowns. Ones, yes.
Like that's almost exclusively, that's probably 90% of my DFS play over the last year. It's just
the best.
Man, there's like an edge in the morning. I'm going to put together like 10 lineups with all morning guys, and I'm going to turn like $50 into like 200. Like that's as, you know, that's about as advanced as I get on this stuff. And honestly, like some of those angles that like we discuss, like I should be putting a lot more money on that because they usually work out when there's a stupid.
I mean, if you feel that there are legit bad pricings because of like weather bumps or like a thing that happens a lot in the format you're talking about, showdown golf, is like guy who sucks on Thursday will be $300 cheaper on Friday and will be 8% mm-hmm. owned instead of 20% owned, and like these are just like very obvious spots that the reason why there is this edge, by the way, in daily fantasy showdown golf is people do not do content for it because the turnaround's too much. Like, right, your content would be good for it from the time the pricing comes out to the time the slate locks. You'd have like 10 hours, maybe 12 hours. So people are not doing content for it. And there are projections for it on the site that I work for, Daily Roto, but a lot of places don't even have, you know, like good projections for it. So that makes the market softer too.
Well, this is fascinating. So you're saying that you know, you can see a signal in the quality of pricing and the quality of, you know, the ability there's a correlation between how great an edge is in any given fantasy game that you play and how much content there is out there for 100% players to judge.
100%. Like think about this. For sure. No one has anything original to say about the NFL. Literally, every word that could be said about an NFL player for a Sunday slate on DraftKings, I couldn't say anything original about it if I took acid and locked myself in a room with a typewriter and tried to say something original. It just is literally an impossibility because too many people are doing it. But like, tennis slates on DraftKings, like not that much content, no good projections. Showdown golf is one of them. Soccer has, the guys over at RotoWire do really good content for it, but there are not like, it's too hard of a game to model at a player level. So like there are big edges in those games a lot. Like if the content and the projections are not super, super like really good and there's not loads of information, there's going to be way more edges on slates.
Wow. God,
everything you're saying too, it's like stuff I use in my head to heads, like my daily golf betting.
Same concept. Yeah.
It's dumb how much of what I do would translate over to DFS and I just don't put time and effort into it. Cause like,
it's a bandwidth question though. Like how much, you know, don't you think something would give, there would be something would suffer.
You've already done the work. Like David.
Yeah. If you've already done the work to determine player values for a day of golf, like on betting round three matchups, that work is like 1-to-1 for especially if Andy was only going to make one team and enter that into like, the $20, the $12, the $5 GPPs, like those teams would all be solid, like probably, I would imagine, without too much extra work.
So what has a higher hold? Where's your money more effectively played?
I mean, the hold for these showdown contests, if you're not entering like the lotto one, which is like $10 to enter, like $10,000 to first, like the hold on that's probably going to be 15%, and there's a good app that you can, or a good Chrome app that you can use that calculates the hold and stuff for you.
Oh, cool.
I would imagine the holds are going to be really similar, like 14-15% probably.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, I've always done just like when I end up doing this, it's like, hey, we have a wave edge. You know, there's guys that are playing in the morning are going to have maybe a stroke and a half edge. Like we definitely need to look at playing some daily what do you call them, showdowns for round two or whatever, what have you. And I'll almost exclusively play like 50-50s or, you know, double ups, whatever, just because it's like, man, these are almost all gonna hit. Like if this doesn't just completely blow up in my face, like this almost always works. So I don't really get into the high tournaments with that because those aren't the kind of lineups I think that blow up and win tournaments. It's not that kind of edge. And I don't know, maybe I'm completely wrong.
I mean, theoretically, like if you are rostering golfers that make a lot of birdies and eagles and stuff, like they should translate pretty well. Like so what I do for showdown a lot of the time is if I have like extra time at night, I will, you know, I'll go up on my computer and I'll get everything set up to do, I'll do, you know, make 100 teams or whatever. But if I like, if I'm just, you know, sitting down at my computer in the morning, it locks at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'll just make one team, you know, I'll use our projections that we have on Daily Roto, and I'll just figure out the values and kind of hand make and just make one team, which I think you could do with the stuff you're doing pretty easily.
Good deal.
Yeah, I mean, half of the stuff I'm doing, like you said, it's not just betting on guys, it's fading at the same time. It's like,
yeah,
man, I have a double edge here. These guys are golfing. These guys are going to golf when the wind kicks up to 20 miles an hour. Like, I'm just going to fade anybody who's golfing after like 1 p.m. because it just doesn't make sense to put any of those in the lineup. And these 50-50s should hit at like an 80% clip. Like, and then I barely put any money on it. It's
but just no, fun. But you, so what you're saying though is like there's a finite number of matchups offered, and sometimes they're engineered in a specific way. Sometimes they're engineered in a way that prevents you from taking advantage of stuff like that. But with you don't necessarily have that ceiling with the daily fantasy, it sounds like, right?
Well, there's triple ups too.
Yeah, I mean, you can get. Theoretically like an infinite amount of action on, I mean, not infinite, but a lot, like, I'm sure as much as Andy would be willing to take on for, you know, if he was like, you know, Byung-Hun An, he's got the good wave split and he's $500 underpriced and he's not going to be like super owned. Like all, you could go all in.
Yeah. I love that. Well, pivoting back to football, I guess another question for you. There's going to be a whole new, you know, every year there's a wave of new players, right? And for sure, where you brought up the DraftKings stock example, for instance, like that's obviously, that is not reflecting reality, right? That is entirely speculative under the assumption that,
yes.
You know, as more states open up and they are a known brand and they have a systematic advantage to capturing market share across all of this new betting space, like, is it, what does that do to daily fantasy, in your opinion? Do you think that there will be competition for the same pot of dollars between all of this year? Is the market robust and mature and established enough in daily fantasy that it exists on its own without really any speed bumps and we only see growth on the betting side? Like, what do you think happens?
So DraftKings and FanDuel, if they had their druthers, they would shut down the DFS sites tomorrow and just have everyone bet, right? They... Sure. The DFS for them right now exists as one, you know, a way to keep their whales happy, because there are guys who have won, you know, millions and millions of dollars on their site who are, you know, super users who are just gonna, like, literally they'll pay $100,000 in rake over the course of a year or whatever.
Market makers, basically.
Yeah, they want to keep those guys happy, so, you know, they don't want to get rid of the product for that reason. But mostly they exist as a customer acquisition arm. And you know, some guy in New Jersey binks the Millionaire Maker week one of NFL. He'll probably keep some money on the site to play DFS, but also hopefully keep some of that money on his DK Sportsbook account, you know, on his FanDuel casino account and play some online blackjack. And so like the DFS sites really do exist as customer acquisition arms for the sportsbooks at this site, like both FanDuel and DraftKings, PointsBet, you know, all these places that exist, they're all in a war to get customers onto the sports books because the sports books are way more profitable.
Then really get them onto the sports books so they can then get them and play in blackjack.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. ultimately oh get God. These dudes playing online slots, right?
Yeah. Right. Right.
That's the happy birthday.
Yeah. So basically the DFS will give them a beer so that they can come smoke some pot betting sports so that they can really get into the heavy stuff down the line with the blackjack.
I don't think that like DFS is dead or anything like that, but I do think like the clear trend line of all of this stuff is more states legalize online sports betting. And they continue to acquire those guys as much as possible. And my hope, obviously, is that, you know, not far behind sports betting is hopefully online poker, and then, you know, that exists as well.
Oh God!
And you think
I know, that the, I totally the, called the pool, a casino today?
Can the pool called of money keep growing, growing? Oh, you did?
Yeah, because I seen something come across from somebody said that Diamond Joe, the Iowa casino that'd be closest to me, is open again. And I couldn't figure out on their website whether the sports book was open, because I wanted to. It's a FanDuel account, and I want to be able to use that again.
Yeah.
And I actually had to call a casino today and be like, hey, is your sports book open or what's going on? Your website doesn't say anything. Oh, no, man, we don't know on that yet. We just want to get people in here to, you know, I know you want people to play slots. It's fine.
Yeah. 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 What, so what then the, is the pool of money available for all of this the same pool, same size roughly, or is it grow exponentially? Like
in terms of, in terms of player funds on the site for DFS?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think like if I was being optimistic, I would say like it's bullish to just have more people have the sportsbook account long-term because theoretically like there shouldn't be any difference. Like it should be easy to use those funds on both DraftKings sportsbook and DraftKings DFS. Like I think it's would be bullish long-term for DFS to have more people with accounts, more people with money on the site. Like if you know, if your Uncle Jerry, you know, if he's got $100 on there to bet on Bears games, like also like, you know, maybe he plays in a $12 contest on the DFS site as well. So like, I think it's bullish to just have more people in the world of like wagering on future outcomes of things for DFS. But I do think sports betting is, you know, the clear directive for these firms.
Mm. Do you think they need to be more creative on the sportsbook side to really capture the type of handle that they're dreaming here? I mean, like for these companies to be worth what the market would tell us they're worth now, we need to be like getting closer to, you know, $1 trillion handle on the Super Bowl, right?
Right. I mean, it's like, and again, like I'm not some like business guru or anything. And like, I know the finance, like I don't have behind the scenes information or anything. Like I just can kind of see the direction, like, you know, the big DFS sites, you know, like RotoGrinders and like the company that I work for, SportsGrid, like we are all, like all of our stuff is facing towards like, how can we do more betting content? How can we do more shows about betting? How can we get betting on TV? How can we partner with MGM and Betfair and, you know, all these companies? So my general feeling is that it's in that direction. I don't know how creative you have to be to get people to want to bet on sports. Like, it's like, you know, we see in countries where it's just always been legal, right? Like, I don't know. Has betting ever been illegal in the United Kingdom? Probably better question not. For you guys. Yeah. Like it's literally just any, like, I listen to this soccer podcast, the Guardian Football Weekly, which anyone who likes soccer, by the way, great podcast, good listen. And these guys are journalists, right? They are not sports betting experts. They don't do sports betting content, but these guys are like, oh yeah, I bet $5 on that game or whatever. Like it's just an ingrained part of what people do in that part of the world if they are interested at all in sports. And my guess would be long term, that's the hope that American sports media takes the direction of, where it's just like, you know, you have Dan Patrick being like, oh yeah, I bet $100 on the Cowboys in this game, just like very casually working it in, like just like that's a part of what we do.
Yeah, I think you just nailed it though, which is the culture over there is $5 bets and the culture over here is $100 bets.
Very true. Yeah, that's the American way.
Yeah, no, the whole American odd system just makes everybody want to bet $100, or at least some multiple of it. It's kind of silly.
Or $10, right? $10 or $100. Never 50.
Yeah. No, it's funny, like you mentioned, it makes me think, like, how long have they been just degenerates over in England?
Well, that's just it, though. They don't play
forever. It's they're probably betting like, on jousting.
Why is the average size of the stake of the punter so low over there relative to here?
Because it is a part, because everyone does it, right? If
everyone's adjusted, problem gambling's not as big a deal over there, or what?
Well, I think problem gambling still exists over there. Like, there's been stories of, like, you know, old soccer players and coaches and stuff, they get into it and it, you know, leads them to a life of ruin or whatever. You know, you get that everywhere. But my guess would be that they have less instances of that because it's like, you know, it's just like whatever, you know, your grandma bets $5 on the Sunderland game on the weekend, you know?
Yes, right. Right.
Well,
right.
It's like every, you see that, like, especially in old pictures of like the pub, you go down to the pub and there's a chalkboard behind it and it has like the, you know, the football matches on there and everybody, or boxing big over there.
Yeah. 100%.
They bet on a just all kinds of stuff that we don't really get into as much over here, but it's just so, like you said, it's ingrained into the society, and maybe that's why people, and I'd love to see that, because like I almost tried to call Drew out a little on, like, do we know their average bet size is actually smaller, or is it anecdotal? But like, I feel like I feel like it probably is.
Just yeah, anecdotally, I feel very strong.
And I still feel like it's probably accurate, because it's just kind of a little part of their lifestyle. Like, you know,
yeah,
like,
every corner,
like, people
has
play fantasy here. Like, everybody just, oh, it's my team, I'm going to bet on them because it's my squad.
Actually a great point you make. They don't play season long fantasy there at all. Like, they don't do like going to do a draft with their buddies. Just like, that is totally foreign to them. Whereas like, everyone plays in a fantasy football league in the United States, right? Like, sure. It's literally like a huge permeation. And like, that's that, like, the actual biggest market of all this stuff is season long fantasy football. That is the biggest money generator in all of this stuff that we're talking about is season long fantasy football.
And that's mostly just because of the eyeballs, right? I mean, just because the participation is so high.
Yeah. And everyone, so let's say
those are all no
the barrier, you know, the barrier to entry is so low.
So low. Like, and you figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, we had a freaking TV show, right? The League, like, it is very similar to how they make $5 bets. We do $20 leagues with our coworkers or our friends or whatever.
Sure. So then here's the $1 million question, maybe the $1 billion question, which is, are we overestimating how many $100 bettors there are in America? Is that a function of the fact that people are, you know, largely betting on credit? And it's a different world if you're betting on credit than if you're posting up. And maybe like the natural evolution here is, if you're going to grow the number of players from 10,000 to 100,000, that 90,000 you're getting, maybe they're all $5 players.
In the world we live in now, like, I would have probably had a different answer to this question 6 months ago, but you know, we're literally seeing record jobless claims. Like, the median income, you know, the gaps are all widening here in the States. Like, in the world we live in now, I think maybe it's possible we're overestimating the number of $100 bettors, but maybe underestimating the number of $1,000 bettors, right? Like, that could be a thing where, like, it just becomes like a luxury activity almost.
Sure. That's about that. A lot of $1,000 bettors aren't really allowed to play at some of these books we're naming.
That's a whole other conversation. If they're bad, they are, right? If they're chasing bad lines, then they're fine.
Yeah, right. Like, $5,000 bettors aren't actually $5,000 bettors. They're $500 bettors with 10 accounts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Or 10 right. other people's accounts.
Currently, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other than the Mattress Max of the world, right?
I mean, there is fantasy, like, I've seen fantasy EPL, like, the, you know, people in England, they talk about their, like, they're managing their team or whatever. And I feel like it's actually, I think it's the actual league that manages it. Like, I think you play through the actual Premier League's website.
I'm not 100% sure. But it's not, I've played that game. It's not for money. Like, there's like a top, like, if you get first overall, you win.
Yeah,
it's like a car or something.
Yeah, you're
it's
not
huge.
A league of like 10 people. It's everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's done on like salary cap, and you like add guys, and they you can use like emergency substitutions. It's just like, to the American mind, like, I've never had the patience for it. I start it every year and I give up by like week 6.
Well, here's one last final question for you, and it's kind of a downer, so sorry to put this at the end, but I feel like the fantasy space has been pretty poor at handling PR crises.
super bad.
The one you mentioned, and a couple of other ones I've heard of, have been abject disasters. Like, are they prepared for the potential, you know, the coming, you know, PR battle that is, you know, the problem gambling that comes along with acquiring 100,000 new customers?
I would assume that they have hired better people, right? I would just think I would just think that they would be better at it, that they would have more plans, that they would be able to take examples of, you know, the way they handle it in Australia and the United Kingdom and India, you know, wherever sports betting is. But like, Yeah, like we have in the outline here, like problem DFSers. Like I'm sure it exists, but I can't recall.
Besides Andy.
Yeah, I can't recall hearing much about it.
Yeah, no, it's they've kind of avoided this, and I don't know if that's good or bad, right? Like it could be bad because they don't have the experience, they don't have the playbook, but maybe it's good in that just people like won't ever really have the stomach or the spirit to go after them. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
The guy, you know, you told the little story about the guy banks $1 million and he leaves some like, I don't have the DraftKings betting app. We don't have that around here. Like I have FanDuel. Minnesota's not legal yet, mostly offshore. But like, how easy have they made that? Like, I have the DraftKings app.
It's very easy. So I went like, to
moving it from DFS to betting. Is it really easy?
So I went to New Jersey for the Giants Dolphins game week 15 or 16 to go meet up with the Dolphins running back Laird and.
Oh, nice.
And we like literally like we touch down in New York. We get over to New Jersey and I'm like immediately like FanDuel app. I'm playing online blackjack like right away. Like no way. just right in. Like it is not hard.
Well, I mean, if you have a DFS bankroll, like how easy is it to take that and use it to sports bet? Like, can you transfer from one to the other?
So if I remember this, and if I get this wrong, anyone listening, I'm sorry. If I remember DraftKings, it was just 1-to-1 where I could bring it over and it was not segregated. And I think on FanDuel, I had to deposit. Like I think the sports book, or maybe it was just the FanDuel casino was, maybe I just had to put money on that. Cause I think they have a deal. I think in the States, FanDuel has a deal with Betfair to use their online casino. So maybe that was why I had to put money on, but I remember it on DraftKings not having to deposit more money. But again, that could be wrong. Like I could be misremembering that, but I don't remember having to deposit money, or maybe I did and I got a free bet or something. And that's why I wanted to deposit. But I think you can move the money, but maybe not. I don't know. I'm not being helpful right now.
I know that's my whole, I was going to go to Iowa today to test this out because like, I keep seeing people posting, oh, like, hey, here's a good price, but it's at FanDuel. I'm like, motherfucker, I don't have FanDuel yet. Like I've driven down there and placed bets, but I need to go down there and get the mobile app because in a roundabout way, I feel like
let me ask Iowa, one of my buddies right now.
Yeah, I feel like if I'm physically in the state of Iowa, I should be able to use the app.
And I think that's true, isn't it?
So
you can. Yeah. If you were in the borders, because I live in Missouri, and when I was in New Jersey, I could use the app.
Yeah, because it's over an hour to this casino, but I can get to Iowa just driving
10 minutes.
You know, straight line, book it for the border, cross the border, place some bets, which would just make me laugh to begin with. But just because it's like a few times I've placed a bet and somebody's like responded like, "Hey, it's this price at FanDuel." I'm like, man, I would consider driving to the border to place that bet right now, or I don't know how complicated their technology is, if you can override that somehow. I don't want to
get this is no, I mean the VPNing is a whole big it's a barrel of worms right now in the online poker community, actually.
Yeah. I feel like they use GPS technology to geofence you. Like you can't just VPN say, hey, I'm using a computer in Des Moines.
I actually got banned on that once, trying to enter contests. I didn't know it was a banned state in Montana. I guess for whatever reason, I went there to go see some family and I couldn't enter into games. So I tried to VPN and what it actually does is it's like, oh, you didn't travel from Missouri to Kansas in 8 seconds. So boom, banned. And like that's how it works.
They gotcha.
Yeah, wow. They got me.
Wow.
No, that's how they – God, that's – yeah, it's like the first time I want to say maybe the first trip to Vegas that we did during like a football season. My buddy's like
– yeah, can't play DFS place, in Vegas. Yeah,
he had a guy get hurt, and he's just like, I'm just screwed on all these lineups. Like, this guy's in my lineups. I can't even open my app.
Well, now yeah, – I know now else. if you enter – before you get like, so if I'm in Missouri, I drive to a banned state. If I've already entered my contest, I can edit the lineups.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a good deal.
That's mighty nice of them.
It's all very complicated. I wish they would make it.
I know they, but US, like federal from level, a business please. Standpoint, like making it so, hey, do you have a bunch of DFS money? You should bet it. Hey, do you have a bunch of betting money? You should play DFS. Like making those, that one bankroll would, that would be a huge boon, I'd think.
Yeah. Remove the firewall. Right.
Yep. Just throw it all in the same pot.
Just looking at the numbers from New Jersey gaming, and you know, in the lack of sport, how many people are playing blackjack in the casino? It is eye opening, and it certainly isn't causing an uproar of, you know, pearl clutching. It's mostly just causing a stampede of investment. Like, I feel like, I guess that's good. I guess
I remembered correctly. FD is FanDuel is segregated. DraftKings is not, in terms of the roles between the two sites.
Yeah. Okay.
I got to figure out where there's a DraftKings in Iowa too. I'm going to do like a barnstorming tour of Iowa, getting all the mobile apps in my phone.
Yeah. Yes. The FanDuel Sportsbook in New Jersey, that's a place. Don't know if I would ever,
yeah.
Don't know if I would ever go back.
Oh, which casino is it in? Or is it not?
It's at a racetrack.
The Meadowlands track, yeah.
Yeah, not like going to the sports book at the Wynn. Very, very different.
Oh, I just looked up where the DraftKings is in Iowa, and it's at the Wild Rose Casino and Resort.
Anybody
has the time.
Camping trip.
Yeah, no, it's funny you should say that. If somebody wants to pull up a Google satellite image of Wild Rose Casino and Resort in Clinton, Iowa, there is a giant, I believe this is the one, has a big spot for parking RVs next to it. Like, it's mostly RV parking. It's in the middle of nowhere. Yes, I'm going to Clinton, Iowa.
All right. Get the RV up, man. All right. Well, that was great. You answered all my questions and more about the daily fantasy industry. We'll have to do a part two of this after I kind of digest some of this and come up with a dozen more.
Yeah. We're getting golf back. Andy, you could be playing Outlaw Tour DFS, man. What are you doing?
That might be.
We got some hot leads on some Outlaw and some Cactus. There's no Cactus DFS?
No. They might be the same thing.
Oh, okay.
No, they're not. Cool. Outlaw Tour is different.
Outlaw's the dudes. Cactus is the gals.
Oh, yeah, okay.
I've stayed a little bit away from that. God, is there two Wild Roses? Yeah, there's one in Emmitsburg. My goodness. Now I've gone down this Iowa casino rabbit hole.
Anyway, how about you? You placed any NFL futures so far?
Yeah. Got.
Oh, you got some positions?
Yeah. Right when odds first came out, bet Kyler at every book I had money in between 33 and 45 to 1,
yes,
for MVP, and Dak at 20 to 1, and Dallas to win the Super Bowl at 22 to 1.
Oh man, we're simpatico. Those are great plays, great numbers, yes, too. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they're good, like the Kyler number is like the most insulting thing ever. It's like, you want to bet Kyler 8 to 1? There, take it or leave it.
That's in stark contrast to like the Mitch Trubisky number from last year, which was insane for a different reason.
Yeah.
Realistically, the MVP market, the handicap is super simple. Is the team, you know, you have a very small pool of players that can actually win the MVP. And
yeah,
there's a lot of names. The hold becomes massive. The more players you have, the more options you have, the bigger the hold is. But you can winnow that down real quick by only looking at quarterbacks and only looking at quarterbacks who are on teams that have a realistic chance of winning double-digit games. And I agree, the Cardinals are going to be a vastly improved team this year. Hopkins is going to be a massive part of that improvement, but they had a very nice draft on top of that. Cliff Kingsbury's system in year two, Kyler, if he uses his legs at all this year, which I felt like he underutilized his running ability last season.
We just got to get them to stop kicking field goals, right? That's the biggest enemy to the Arizona Cardinals. Like, if they just made field goals illegal, they could have won like 8 games last year.
Well now that they're not going to waste 2 downs in every red zone attempt by handing off to David Johnson, I think that's a realistic chance that we'll see more touchdowns.
Yep, very true.
Hopkins is a wonderful target in the red zone. They absolutely are stacked to perform well statistically. All they got to do is compete with. They got to finish second, I think, in the West. For that ticket to have life,
I think they can win that division. I'm team 49ers, our paper Tigers.
Ooh, wow, that is a hot take.
Because it just doesn't work to run the ball that much. It's just theoretically a team that if they just get unlucky and are trailing by 10 points in games because of bad variance, it's just a lot harder for a team built around running the ball to sustain than it is a team built around passing the ball. Like, obviously the defense is great. Obviously they have a system that's built to score points and gain yards around running the ball, but it's just a lot harder to deal with in-game variance if you're primary mode of moving the ball is running.
I think the Niners offense contains more multitudes than you're giving them credit for, and I think the perception of them as a run first team was afforded by the fact that no one could really stop them. So
yeah,
you're gonna take the easiest road,
the path of least resistance, right?
Every time. If the road to the Super Bowl goes through the likes of the Green Bay Packers, of course you're going to run the ball. So it's right. Like you didn't really have to pass to get there. But I honestly, like, my take during last year's playoffs were that screwed them in the end, because I feel like they absolutely needed to build up Jimmy's confidence more so than they did through the first two playoff games, where they effectively took the ball out of his hands, especially the second half of that Vikings game. They really were like, we're not going to let him kill us. Like, I feel like once the win was
we were holding Niners minus 7 there, though.
I liked the game plan too, but it preserved a win. But I feel like in that Packers game, the Niners win that game against the Packers 95 times out of 100. There were very few paths to victory for the Packers, especially
this is what I need to ask you guys final topic here. Please tell me you did not bet the 49ers in the Super Bowl, either one of you.
I did. I had like a free bet somewhere, and it was basically it was flat plus 100 both sides NFC or AFC wins the Super Bowl, but I had to place it in September. I had the freaking NFC. So all that did was make me put $50 more on the Chiefs, because I'm like, well, it's like 50 free extra dollars I'm gonna bet on the Chiefs at this point. But yeah,
I had two bets on the Niners. The first was they will score on their first possession. Yes. That was at like plus 130, which was insane. And then my second bet was Niners first half money line, which pushed. And I got to tell you, I lost my shit with Kyle Shanahan running out that clock.
Yep. Oh, such a coward move.
And then the offensive PI call on George Kittle was just egregious. It was egregious. He did not gain an advantage on that. That was an egregious play to penalize them. They should have gotten one more score, and that first half bet should have cashed. But no, I mean, our entire narrative that we kind of worked up and all of the content that we created for the Super Bowl was, there's no lead is safe. There was no lead that the Niners could have had at any point in that game until we got down to like 2 minutes to go. If they had a double digit lead, I probably would have been a little sweaty, I guess. But no lead was safe at any point in that game with as explosive as the Chiefs offense was at that time, which I think, bore out to be the defining factor, because Kyle Shanahan was way too conservative, did not score enough points. You're not going to beat the Chiefs 20 points. And he left a lot of points on the field, and that was on him.
I will. I'll never, ever, ever forgive the NFL for giving the MVP award of that game to Mahomes instead of Damian.
Oh, I don't know about that. Really? You think Damian Williams earned the MVP?
25-1. He scores the game-winning touchdown and the game-sealing touchdown. So this is what would have had to have happened for him to win it. The 2-yard Mahomes rushing touchdown that had the pitch option, he just cuts up and takes it. If he pitches that to Damian and Damian scores 3 touchdowns, 140-ish yards, he's got to win it, right?
That's true, yeah.
If he puts I thought up, it was going to be close. One, yeah. Like when they were down before, everyone was betting Chiefs when they were down. And I was pulling up live books, like one after another, and one had live MVP odds, and I mashed a bunch on Mahomes MVP, and I was pretty nervous about that. I'm like, this is like a coin flip for me. Like, I think they'll go quarterback, but it would not have surprised me at all. Like, it was probably a bad beat for people.
I mean, at the end of the day, Mahomes wins like 95% of the time when the Chiefs win. And after that 3rd and 15 completion to Tyreek, it was probably like
that
done.
That was it.
Like, it was, I mean, I just such an amazing moment. But yeah, I'm still salty that I didn't cash that ticket.
You have a right to be salty about that. I think my perception wasn't who was the rightful winner as much as it was you really thought that the Chiefs were going to win a Super Bowl with Mahomes making a comeback and they weren't going to give him the MVP. Like, that story writes itself and sells newspapers, gets clicks. Like, again, same thing like with betting the NFL MVP or any of the kind of qualitative awards that are given out by the media. Like, the game theory that goes into it all speaks to what do the voters vote on? Like, what are they thinking? Yeah. Like, don't make a decision on who you think is the right, who you think has a path to be the rightful best player in the NFL. You have to legitimately think through, Kyler Murray could put up record-setting numbers. He could match Lamar Jackson's stat line exactly next year. But if the Cardinals are 8-8, he's not going to win.
He's not going to win.
Yeah. It's because they always start from the top down in terms of which teams were the best, and they look specifically at, okay, well, who on those teams is worthy, and that's the path that they always go through voting. And as long as you know that.
Funny, yeah. It's funny to say something that we're trying to predict, 10 months ahead of time is predictable. To a certain point, a lot of those award markets, they are pretty predictable, and unless you have, a crazy breakout season, like something that you wouldn't see happening like we had last year. But yeah, it's funny how your mindset changes. Like, you say Lamar, or you say Mahomes was like 95%, or not what were the odds of them not giving him to him after the comeback? But in my head, it was like a coin flip, and it's because I had the ticket. Like, when you have the ticket, you're constantly making the case for the other one. Like, I'm dead. This is a dead ticket. I put too much on it.
Yeah,
this is stupid. Yeah. It's like that. I told this story a couple weeks ago. The Yorgos thing. Like, somebody had a bad Yorgos number, and everybody was betting it. So I'm like, I'll take the bad Yorgos number. And then everything went nuts, and Alfonso Cuarón came back to the pack. And I'm like, well, I have to bet the piss out of this. So all of a sudden, I had a shitload of money on the best director category, way, way more than I thought I should. And I'm looking, and I'm like, God, Spike Lee is due. Like, he's going to win. Like, I had it in my head. Like, Spike Lee is going to win. He was like the third favorite, and it wasn't terrible far behind. And
I remember talking you down on this. It was so obvious they were giving Spike the runner-up, which is the best screenplay. And as soon as he won the best screenplay, you should have just chilled out. It was a done deal.
I did. You talked me down. But in my head, I'm like, I'm going to lose all this money because Spike Lee.
Yeah, that was fun.
And that's why it's a mind game, people.
It is. It very much is.
Cognitive all right, boys. Biases. Learn them.
Yep. Everyone, thank you very much for listening. Whether you listen to this on our feed or their feed, maybe we will. We'll get a part two in there. Probably there definitely is plenty of stuff left to discuss. So Drew and Andy, thank you very much for coming on the show, and or thanks for having me on your show. Either way, depending on which feed you're listening on.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for coming on the deep dive.
Yeah. So everyone, thank you very much for listening. Yep.